So I'd like to welcome Amir from the blog Cold Dark Stars here to Symptomatic Redness. We're going to talk about the interrelationship between scientific studies and socialism, why Amir started Cold Dark Stars, and a few other things that pop up. I highly suggest people check out the blog before listening today. Cold Dark Stars does pieces that are fairly short, pretty easily digestible, but sometimes tackle fairly complex topics. So let's begin. Why did you start Cold Dark Stars about a year ago?
That's a good question. A couple of things. You know, like I spent a lot of time in the internet, and I always posted in forums or in Facebook or something. And I thought, like, I mean, if I'm going to procrastinate, I might as well just, you know, like summarize my views in a presentable format that more people can access, you know, so I feel it's less waste of my time. And also, I feel there's an unfilled niche in leftist theoretical writing, especially of a Marxist bent, that is readable, but not patronizing. So I wanted to write something that anybody that has a college education can understand, you know, instead of specialists understanding it, which I think is the case of a lot of theory writings in Marxist circles, where you have to be like seasoned in certain jargon and ideas to understand them. And I think a sign of a good writing is simply, you know, like someone that has a good reading comprehension should be able to understand what you're saying, you know, or the gist of what you're saying.
You also write about topics that are not as commonly written about on left theoretical or even left like popular blogs. Like, you deal with the, you know, what you perceive as a crisis in science right now, and some other things that have completely fallen away out of left discourse. They may have been part of it in like the 90s, but they haven't been in a long time.
To follow up on the first question, that's another important point. I thought I had also beyond this desire to make something that's readable but not patronizing, I also have a more heterodox background than a lot of other people that write this sort of stuff, because like my professional background is science, physics, and what I know about left doesn't come from an academic background necessarily, but from being part of reading circles and my own self-studies, and that's where I got my political education. I didn't get it from, you know, an academic background. So I write from my scientific background, and also the idea of scientific socialism, I take it really seriously. And yes, one of the things I do a lot is think about the how science is nowadays, simply because science is such an integral part of capitalism, like research and development, technology. So it's important to understand how science is coupled to capitalism. So that's why I write a lot about it. And also because it's my turf, so I know about it too.
Why do you think, in a very basic sense, and we'll go in a lot deeper in a minute, why do you think there's so little overlap right now between the scientific community and the Marxist community?
That's a question
it's kind of a big question.
Yeah, it's a big question. But I've thought a lot about it. I mean, it's ultimately it's, you know, there's a secular tendency in capital of more specialization and more division of labor. Mm-hmm. So to some point, it's just simply not beneficial, like time-wise and career-wise, for people to pull too much out of their specialization in science. And it often looks bad. You know, if you usually in your CV, for example, you cannot, if you put something that looks too crazy, that isn't just like, oh, I like playing football or something, but it's like, no, man, I'm a novelist or something on the side, you know, it actually looks bad because it looks unfocused, but also, you know, the time constraints. And there's also there's a whole sociology about division of labor that comes with this. And it hasn't always been the case. You know, you look at Einstein, you know, I love Einstein because he's like what I think. It sounds like cliche, but also not because he's only a very intelligent guy, but I think that's how scientific engagement with the public should look like. Here was a guy who revolutionized physics, but also was a socialist and wrote a very famous socialist essay that defended economic planning in the monthly review. And a lot of the early scientists of the 20th century were like that. But I think after World War II, what you had is a more like much more specialization in science. And for example, Kuhn says that it's related to how the U.S. basically put a lot of money, the U.S. government put a lot of money in science because of the Manhattan Project, for example. And I think that Kuhn argues that's like kind of like a phase transition in the scientific community, because now you have this like institutional framework for publicly funded science that didn't exist before, you know, because the state just took a big interest in science. So that made it more bureaucratic, more fragmentary. Anyway, this is what I think about it, more or less.
So I'm going to build off of that a little bit and maybe tie it to something else. Why do you think that arts academics do not suffer the same stigma for writing outside of their field? Because that's part of why I think there's so much more Marxism done in like art history, even though it's not really directly related at all.
That's an interesting question. I'm not sure about too much about the academic ecosystem of the arts, for example, but I know that definitely it's Marxism in the humanities, even if might not be necessarily a dominant research program, you get some of that in your educational background. So right. That partly that. And there's people who like make academic careers of Marxist analysis. I mean, there aren't that many, but in the humanities, they exist, you right. know? So I think people, and often, you know, like, for example, if you deal with gender or something like that, it's really easy to just start from there and politically engage, you know, because it's very political just since the beginning. While if you're like a physicist, there's not that much overlap and you have to spend a lot of time on it. It doesn't just come up naturally in your trajectory, in your professional trajectory. So there's that. But it's also, so there's, for example, a lot of Marxists in the humanities, but they don't necessarily engage the scientific aspect. For example, one of the things that interests me the most is what's the argument for socialist economic planning and how you can justify it from a quasi-scientific perspective. For example, I like, although Paul Cockshott, I disagree with a lot of his political beliefs, I like at least the spirit of some of the stuff he does. He looks at computer science and how could you do economic planning with current computational technology, which is not, it's interesting because the idea is that a lot of these problems are not computable, but then he tries to make an argument for that. Mm-hmm. So I find that angle interesting.
I feel like socialist planning has a lot of strawman arguments on both sides of it. And when you look at Cockshott's work, you do see that some of these are technical problems. Another thinker that seems to hit on this a little bit is Hillel Tikhon, who shows that a lot of this is a technical problem as well. But Some of it does seem, like you said, not to be able to concretely deal with things that aren't immediately quantifiable. How do you think we should handle that? Because the scientific side of Marxism, historically speaking, so when there's a lot of engineers in it, like Bordiga was in engineering, for example, they tended to either have a very much, we could plan it all down to the exact, you know, chit for token for this specific thing on every element of the human life, or they tended to slip to some kind of hybrid market system that was still kind of quasi-planned, but limited as was still using a market marker as an information point. I mean, and in reality, the Soviet Union still did use a market marker as an information point. And I'm not asking you to answer that question, because obviously you couldn't do that in an interview, and it's huge. But what do you think are the kind of leads, if you were going to set people out to do a socialist research program, all right, if that was a goal, and we wanted to talk about something like the possibility, feasibility of planning, admitting that there are going to be knowledge problems, I'm not saying that in the big, you know, Austrian economic sense right now, there will be gaps of knowledge, and there's also going to be gaps of want. What would you set people to look at?
One of the biggest inspirations, like I actually wrote, that one of the best articles I wrote that has the most reads is, it was the red spot of Jupiter. That's why I call it. I call it a quasi-scientific, because it wasn't like a super empirical take, but I was trying to actually argue against the Hayekian attack on socialist calculation. Well, to summarize, you know, if people are not familiar, is that Hayek basically thought that it's too hard for a central planner to know everything that is required to like efficiently allocate the goods where they are needed. So he instead argued that because of that, he argued that the market is better because instead of having a central planner or let's say a central computer, you have like a, I think of it as a cluster of computational cores, you know, like a huge parallelized computer or something. And instead, like you have various nodes in the market calculating immediately, you know, like supply and demand. For example, a guy that goes to, you know, a corner store and gets a pack of cigarettes. He, by doing that action, he's like, in some sense, imposing his demand. And so, and you could say the same about firms and individuals. And these are all like a distributed computer. And then, you know, like that to him seemed more feasible. And that he thought the market was basically that who seemed more feasible. But the way I think of it is like, one of the biggest inspirations for me is climate science. Mm-hmm. So, or and astrophysics too, which is actually my background. So, stars are very complex in the sense that, you know, you have a blob of hot gas, but there's like a climate in the stars. You know, like each kilometer square, there's like, you know, like turbulence and there's a temperature gradient, a pressure gradient. So, can we model a star? Can we know exactly what happens at every kilometer square every second? No. But there's global things we can model, you know, we can model the global temperature, we can model its radius. Similarly, in climate, it's the same thing with climate and weather. So climate science deals with, and the people that study climate change usually with, for example, global mean temperatures. So you can predict how the some global quantities of the Earth evolve in some time scales, like large time scales and large length scales, for example, at planetary levels, but maybe you cannot know what's the weather inside a kilometer square at a specific time. You know, that's why weather forecasting is really hard. So you can only weather forecast basically one day beyond or something. So that's how I see planning. Like, just because we don't know in climate science, like it would be ridiculous to say climate science is useless because our planning around global warming is useless because we cannot know the weather at the city, like at a specific time. It's the same analogy. You know, there's gonna be coarser qualities that you can know of society and you can plan around even if you cannot know all the little specific details, you know? So that's how I see of it. I don't see it as you have to know absolutely everything. But you can know things and we know and plan around them. And that's what climate science is. So Hayekian argument against planning will basically in a strong form will mean there will not be astrophysics or climate science, you know?
Or any science at all, really. I mean,
almost science at all, except really fundamental, like, I don't know, like maybe all science is just particle physics or something, some really simple basic system, but that's not the case, right? So I think like people are just, for ideological reasons, are more critical about those attempts in the economic sphere because of its socialistic implications, more so than other established sciences that have actually to deal with huge amounts of uncertainty at the smaller scales too.
Yeah, so one of the things that I've enjoyed about this problem that you brought up in a recent post on crisis theory, and you and I both kind of agree that a lot of crisis theory in Marxism is a little bit cranky in that it's not even falsifiable. And I realize falsifiability has issues too, but I don't even know how you would do Bayesian analysis on it, how you would establish true priors, even though it's supposed to go through a cyclic system, right? So, your recent writing on crisis theory as complexity actually also gets into this knowledge problem question. And I'm specifically thinking about something you wrote very recently, where you talked about overly complex systems and fragility in planning. And one of the things you clearly show is cost disease as something that happens in capitalist administration and even in quasi-socialist administration, but altogether, whenever there's capitalism involved, gets exponential. The systems are too complicated to be administered by just the market, clearly. And also, they're not really efficiently administered internally. There's no efficiency mechanisms at all. They just multiply. And you have hard numbers on that. And the interesting thing to me about that is I don't hear socialists talking about that enough. I hear libertarians talking about it, but I don't hear socialists talking about it, because a lot of socialists seem to have a very naive view of the state and our relationship to that. But what do you make of cost disease and administrative drift and a knowledge problem?
I'm glad you picked up that article, because one of my favorites that I've written, but it's not necessarily the most popular I've written. So I'm glad to discuss that one. So here's the counterintuitive part. So I think when people think about planning, they think that things are more complicated because you're trying to you're trying to build a bureaucracy to force a system to go from A to B instead of it just being spontaneous. But the problem is that in capitalism, so people, when they think about planning, they think, oh, the way society is right now. And how would you make a similar society right now with planning? But so obviously there's a lot of what I refer as fragile complexity today in society, in the sense that, you know, you have, I'm going to talk, a guy that talked a little bit about it, about this Joseph Tainter guy in some of my writings. He's an anthropologist. Mm-hmm. And he had this very interesting theory of rise and fall of civilizations. So he said that civilizations are fundamentally problem solving machines. And for example, you know, let's say, how to deal with, you know, in ancient societies, ancient Mesopotamia, about within irrigation and agriculture. So society problem solved, and then figure out we can do this irrigation systems, but that require a layer of specialists and infrastructure you add to it. So Tainter said that what happens to autonomous civilizations is that there's marginal diminishing returns in complexity versus problem solving at some point. So, for example, he argues that that's what happened to the Roman Empire. The infrastructure increased in complexity in order to solve specific problems, you know, like, let's say, from invasions to, shortages. And this kept adding layers of infrastructure specialists. But at some point, the infrastructure and the complexity was too expensive compared to, the energy output from agriculture or the caloric output of agriculture. So at this point, it collapses in something simpler. Now, I don't agree that law is necessarily as universal as he thinks. I think it actually is way worse in capitalism, because capitalism runs at much more faster times, because so you have firms trying to solve specific problems that are not related to social need. They are related to the profits. So, you know, Amazon, Walmart, they are not interested about solar wind. They're interested about making more money. So sometimes the way they make more money is, for the firm, is adding infrastructure and specialists, but they also have this diminishing returns problem. And at some point you get this extremely bloated complexity that exists in the market. You know, for example, you can see it in a simple one is cause disease. You know, you see healthcare just first, it doesn't necessarily get cheaper as technology grows. And also you can see in healthcare, for example, that you have the administrative layer of professionals has increased exponentially compared to doctors and nurses.
Mm-hmm.
So that's complexity added. But capitalism does these things usually because a firm is trying to make profit, or an institution, or something very specific. But there's no holistic view of how this makes the economy more fragile for everyone. You know, you have this fragile complexity, you know, like a giant house of cards that is really big, but also really fragile, that, you know, there's an economic shock and it's interconnected to everything. So it just kind of ripples everywhere. You know, that's what global recessions are. You know, you have certain bubbles in the housing market in the US, and because of the fragile and interconnected complexity, it just ripples throughout the whole world.
Mm-hmm.
You know? So to reel it back, capitalism kind of creates its own knowledge information problems because of its really opaque complexity. So I think part of socialist planning will be to actually make, you know, get rid of unnecessary complexity.
Mm-hmm.
You know, that exists in firms, you know, in private enterprises. There's all, if you go to Google Scholar and look papers concerning management, people talk about expensive complexity and how to deal with it and how to streamline it. So that's the thing, but it doesn't will exist in a global scale. It's more like little atomized firms doing that for profit motives, not for social need profit. So the complexity of FIRE is profitable to finance people. You know, mm-hmm. It's a very complex, interconnected planetary system. So it's profitable to them, but it makes society much more fragile.
So you have an issue, and it's an issue also that is easier handled in socialist kinds of economies because, and I've talked about this before, one of the reasons why in the U.S. there's no real push to streamline and fix a lot of the healthcare problems for the consumer and the doctors is that it would cause a massive unemployment problem right now. And so a single sector fix in the economy can't deal with that. Like it can't, like if you say, let's say you have Medicare for all, but everything else stays exactly the same. You're going to have a massive unemployment. Well, not a massive, but you're going to have a large unemployment problem with middle-class jobs who are going to backlash on you as a voting bloc. That isn't going to happen, right, in a more socialized economy or in a, hopefully, a real socialist economy because the risk incentives are different for able to streamline.
Yeah, exactly. There's also that. So related to that, there's actually also some of the complexities, rent seekers, you know, that exist in the state. Like, for example, a great example is that everybody loves to hate is university administration. You know, like, I do believe, and probably a lot of people do, like, I don't think it's a controversial opinion that, like, admins, a lot of them are rent seekers, you mm-hmm. know, so they are not producing wealth for society, but they are directing wealth to the institution and to themselves. That doesn't mean that it necessarily makes the world wealth grow, mm-hmm. but it directs some of the wealth to these rent seekers that, because at the end of the day, you know, you have rent seekers in the leadership of some of these, especially like many of public enterprises, but that's not only the only place. In fact, universities, a lot of them in the US are private, so you still have the same problem.
Yeah, working in universities, both publicly and privately, I saw that was consistent. I remember At a very young point in my life when I had kind of conservative ideas, I thought, oh, private institutions won't have the same administration bureaucratic drift. Well, they have it, and sometimes worse. Like
exactly. No, exactly. It's because what you have is that these rent seekers start to capture both public institutions and firms. You know, like, for example, university admins capturing the private university also mm-hmm. instead, not only the public university, and once they capture it, you know, they create pseudo problems. That's how we refer them. So sometimes there's not really, or the problem is insignificant and it's not real, but you create the whole framework for that problem. And now you have to add other rent seekers to solve this non-problem, you know? So they create like informational complexity by themselves, mm-hmm. you know?
I experienced that firsthand when I worked for the public school system in the United States, particularly in the state of Georgia, where when we started having problems getting our graduation up above 83%, we were mandated by the state to hire a bunch of consultants at about $100,000 a year. Well, that's two teachers that they didn't have to lay off, which cycles the problem through, making what was a small problem of not being able to get attainable goals into a much bigger one, and also becomes a funding issue. And I saw that all over education, like, and it's something that in the United States, the kind of soft left doesn't talk about either, because they also kind of encourage it. This is not me being critical of them, it's just when you have a defensive position that we have to defend the institutions, yeah. and no matter what, and these rent seekers are part of the institution, then you can't really do a whole lot about that. But conversely, the idea that markets fix it, I found that quasi-markets, neoliberal-style public-private partnerships make it way worse. They accelerate the problem.
Yeah, because of contractors and consultants. And another important part when I think about, like, the complexity is not just rent-seeker. That's part of it. Like, I don't think finance is rent-seeking, at least understood.
I don't think so either, but go ahead.
It's not rent-seeking, but I think it's part of this. Like, capitalism needs finance, you know? Because what finance does is that it's like a fast-paced distributive mechanism of goods. So it kind of works as a oil that greases the machinery. So, for example, a lot of firms, individuals, businesses don't have the start. A very good example is you don't have the startup cash flows from your savings. So you need to actually get credit from the financial sector. And that makes you create a business when you otherwise wouldn't, because you don't have the savings. That generates, in some sense, that's important for capitalism because it makes, you know, it generates all these firms that wouldn't be there before. And at the same time, it's profitable for the people involved in finance as well. So to me, that's like complexity added by capitalists to problem solve the problem of, let's say, like the problem that people might not have initial credit or even, you know, there might be holes in aggregate demand and you use the finance sector to plug them in, you know? So this is a problem solving mechanism created by capitalism, but it's also very expensive. Expensive in a social sense because it's fragile, you know, like I think that's uncontroversial, you know, like the Great Recession in 2018 showed that, you know, post-Keynesians like Minsky were going off about it like decades ago about the fragility of the financial system. Mm-hmm. But it's necessary for capitalism, you know, but it's like expensive complexity added that wouldn't exist in a socialist society that's based around social need because finance is fundamentally about a society that's based on making profitable firms, you know, which is not the same as making socially necessary institutions.
So I'm going to switch gears for a second. We'll probably come back to this, but I wanted to talk to you a little bit about, I'm going to try to phrase these questions because we talked about this earlier. You, for professional reasons, we're just going to call you by your first name. But you and I know each other, obviously, and there is I mean, we've actually met in person, but there is something interesting about your background that you bring to socialist analysis that socialists ostensibly believe in, but don't often talk about, particularly weirdly right now, and that is internationalism. And I know that your immediate family represents the entire, like, most of the span of North America. Like some small countries aside, but you know, almost all the big countries are represented in your immediate outlook. You've also written about world systems theories versus a lot of national, and I say national socialist, I here don't mean Nazis, but like kinds of national Keynesian programs, New Deal programs and stuff like that. What do you think the left that you write about and you're writing to is on internationalism and understanding that their problems are not just national problems?
Well, it's a question I think a lot about because there are certain aspects of contemporary leftism that scratch on that internationalism in a very tip of the iceberg sort of way. For example, now in the US you have and in Europe you have problems with immigration, refugees. In the US, like the Democratic Party has become maybe not the most popular point, but it's sufficiently mainstream, like the abolition of ICE, you know. Mm-hmm. The sentiment behind this left is like, yeah, these guys, you know, they cross the border. Well, these guys cross the border like without documents. So on the rule of law premises, it's illegally, right? Mm-hmm. But then they come on the idea that, you know, but at the same time, we shouldn't like charge them or deport them or something, just kind of pretend it's not there or something, you know, almost. That's the feeling I get. Like, I almost get that the ICE conundrum is like, okay, enforce the borders, but what if you are able to, like, just kind of, like, cross it illegally, but you make it, you know, that it's okay. You know, but completely here to be, you know, like, it's, and then, like, right-wingers, you know, say, oh, the Democrats want open borders or the liberals want open borders because of this and that. But obviously, you know, people in the mainstream want to say that necessarily because it sounds crazy, but they're scratching on something because it's like, wait a second, you believe in nation state and rule of law and in taxation, but you don't want to enforce it or something.
Yeah. So,
for example, to me, the whole idea of open borders, which some people in the left just kind of entertain too, but like, it's to me, like, it's a distraction. It's not about open borders, but world government, you know? If you're talking about open borders, you're talking about world government in some sense or the other.
But no one wants to say that. Like, that's a bigger, scary thing.
It sounds crazy and also sounds like totalitarian or something, you know? And the left has this obsession with local, small is beautiful kind of thing.
Save the bordegas, yeah.
Yeah, exactly. So to me, it's simple. A tweet made by Trump can affect the price of tortillas the next day, you know? Mm-hmm. Like, we live in this extremely coupled world system, and if you really want to, like, manipulate the economy for the benefit of the social good, you have to do it on a planetary scale. Why? For example, garden variety developing country, you know? Mm-hmm. So there's a lot of instances in the developing world where, you know, some countries have tried to like implement really large fiscal deficits and also implement large scale nationalizations. Mm-hmm. The world economy castigates them with inflation, with depletion of forex reserves, with capital flight. And for example, at the end of the day, like a country will need in the world market dollars to get the medicine that is produced in some first world country, or to get the computer parts necessary to manage a hospital. They need dollars to get the computers from the first world, because that's where they have the capital intensive industries and the intellectual and the trade secrets to make those things. So to me, it's very simple, like, because no country on earth, except like maybe the US, is materially or monetarily sovereign. So a country cannot, in this complex economy, produce everything it needs, especially in terms of technology. Mm. And so because of that, they have to import, and that makes them subject to, you know, things like the value of their currency compared to the dollar and stuff like that. Because of that, like the import, at the end of the day, you will need some sort of world government, you know, or at least some sort of world government like infrastructure.
And such things kind of exist under a capitalist order now, actually, when you talk about the WTO, various trade courts, international treaty courts, not really the UN. The UN sucks at its job, but like, yeah. I don't, you know, it's not cool to be anti-UN, and I'm not really anti-UN, but if you look at its mission, it's pretty much failed at every key thing it's supposed to do. But that may not be its fault, right? So those things kind of exist in some way now, but the idea of them as like a world state scares the crap out of a lot of people, including a lot of leftists, because to a lot of people it smells like imperialism.
Let's put it this way. So I think a lot of the scare from progress beliefs comes from the idea that the world is extremely heterogeneous. Mm-hmm. You know, there's so many different ways of lives and of perspectives. And I think that also is related to the critical theory turn of the 60s in academia, post-structuralism, and a lot of theories that were really fashionable for many decades in leftist circles are about like heterogeneity, you know, how everything is too heterogeneous to be able to sufficiently understood. And in some sense, if you cannot understand it, that it's ungovernable from just one body. It's true there's like specificities, but bureaucratic rationality has capital, and bureaucratic rationality has crossed almost all borders, you know, like country, like peoples that you could say that live like extremely different forms of life are usually, you know, small hunter-gatherer societies or something like that, like a smaller percentage of the population than people think, because most people are, in some sense, for example, I think right now like 50% of the global population lives in cities, and it's in urban areas, and it's going to increase as time goes on. So, you know, a modern city is subject to bureaucratic rationality in the sense that, you know, there's an idea of rule of law that protects, in capitalism, it's related to, you know, private property, an idea of how the law should be enforced, you know, the idea of the police. So this bureaucratic rationality exists everywhere. So I don't think people are as different as some leftists think, that they cannot coexist in one world republic. You know, I think, because you see, there's heterogeneity too within countries, you know, like,
we just look at Mexico, like, it's way more heterogeneous than people realize. If you look at the different native groups or the various immigrant groups, issues. I mean, like, when I lived in Mexico, one of the most fascinating things that I didn't know was one of the few quasi-acceptable forms of racism that you could state was against the Chinese. And because of large Chinese immigration, and there's a history there. And like, but what's weird about that is it doesn't actually rhyme with the American history of the exact same thing. But the things that spurred it are similar. So in all countries, and I don't pick on Mexico, because Mexico is actually remarkably good at integrating other people into its culture. Like, it's a very warm culture. But even in that scenario, those things still happen. And I also think about, like, you and I have talked about settler colonial discourse, and, like, there's a lot of truth to that. I'm not going to, I could argue it in pedantic points, but in the base it's true, but a lot of these societies that are on the left doesn't see as settler colonial totally are too. Like, almost all of Latin America really is heterogeneously settler colonial, but it all kind of lives together and somehow functions. Like, there are tensions, there are historical wrongs, and, you know, I'm one of those people who doesn't think that socialism is going to immediately just fix all that, but yeah. I don't think we can even, like, pretend to get there at this point, just from simple wealth accumulation. Like, there's no real way to fairly deal with that under capital wealth accumulation. There's just not.
Yeah, exactly. At least in a socialist society that's based around social need and not impact. Because the problem of capitalism is this. For example, the issue of First Nations in Canada. For example, there's always these problems of pipelines being run under communities where First Nations live. To cap, like the state, which manages a capitalist economy, you know, obviously wants to get the oil underground to sell it to generate revenue. You know, that's the logic it operates on. Social need is second or third, no, not even second order, like higher order term in how it acts. So if profit is the motive, that's just simply gonna come first over actual social need. And at the very least, I was reading an essay from, I don't remember the essay, but I was reading recently an essay from Ralph Miliband, and that's one of the points he makes about socialists. You cannot claim that socialists can fix all problems, but you can claim that at least it gives you a framework to try to fix them. The problem with capital is that it's done, everything is ad hoc. If social needs comes out, it's ad hoc. So, you know, like maybe some guy like found that this medicine, discovered medicine that's extremely profitable, and then as an ad hoc secondary effect, it happens to solve a social problem. You know, it's always like that. So the idea is that capitalists by ad hoc solve social problems, but that to me is a roundabout, indirect way of, if you want to solve a problem, solve it. You don't just do it in this roundabout. Like for example, one of the weirdest things to me is like policy on climate science. So right now the mainstream policy is probably carbon pricing. You know, you price externality. So you make a, I don't know exactly how these models work, and I'm actually skeptical you can do that, but you look at the damaging effects carbon will do in the, like carbon emissions will do in the future. You know, let's say there might be some concrete, I guess, like some ecological damage quickly can translate into future economic damages as well. And from that, you generate an algorithm and say, like, this is actually how much carbon costs, you know, like looking at these externalities. And then you add it and then you hope that because it's more expensive now, like just naturally green energy or renewables will overcome it, or naturally companies will start lower emissions, will have lower emissions of carbon. But it's such a roundabout indirect way of solving the problem, you know? And while you can just like, I don't know, you can have like public ownership of these companies and operate from that, from what the society, what, you know, like a future socialist society that knows all the issues, that is, has access to the knowledge of what these things could do, you know, decide. You know, that's the other problem. In capital, people say like, oh, you know, capitalism is very honest because you, just by, with your dollar, you're voting on something, essentially. But people don't really have information on what they are buying. Like, you just get pushed things in your face, commodities in your face, and you have this very partial information about it, and that's why you buy them. There's no idea, for example, like, okay, maybe if this industry exists, it means I'm gonna have to work 12 hours a day instead of five or something, you know, there's no information like that. So to me, part of a socialist society is that there's knowledge around what each decision entails because you're part of the decision, you know, instead of just like, oh, this like looks cool or something and I buy it in spite of there being like this whole complexity and infrastructure behind it, you know, that might affect your life in ways you don't like, you know?
Or don't see or know, even after you buy it. Right, yeah. So, I mean, knowledge asymmetry is one of those things that when I was, again, I think back to my early 20s when I kind of had a conservative bent, did bug me. Because I'm like, well, if the market is supposed to be an epistemological fix where both sides can communicate, don't we have to actually know all the effects? All the, I mean, and we can't even get like basic things like, it's been very hard to legislate. I mean, and you had to legislate it to get things like calorie counts on food, like just so you can make more rational choices. I mean, like,
yeah, exactly. Oh, that, yeah, that's a great question. Yeah,
that, I mean, that completely changed my eating habits when I saw calorie counts. Like, I'm not kidding. And some of it's counterintuitive too. I mean, like, so when I think about that sort of thing, I think a lot about what you're talking about. Now, I picked up on something earlier that you mentioned that it's a little bit more esoteric for those who are not into heterodox economics, but there was a subtle critique you were making that I don't you didn't state explicitly, but was obviously aimed at modern monetary theory, about currency sovereignty. Would you like to go into what you see as the problems of modern monetary theory as a left-wing thought?
I actually wrote a... not a post about that, which was actually one of the that got most like angry comments. It was Keynes against the world system, and I use modern monetary theory as an example. The problem is that with modern, well, in my experience is that some of it is so can be kind of obscure and counterintuitive that it's really easy to move the goalposts. You know, so you say something and they say you don't understand it, you know?
Right. They'll say basically, well, that currency crash is because they were really secretly pegging it to the dollar in some way that you didn't see and was never stated formal policy. And I'm like, but that's because to buy anything on a world market, you got to buy it on a dollar. So there's no way not to peg it to a dollar. The other thing that's kind of the elephant in the room, if the U.S. has currency sovereignty, it's because we have the most guns.
Exactly. That's what I think. Like, the reason why... the reason why modern monetary theory may work in a U.S. context may work because we don't know. That's like the... So, for people who, I guess, a little bit to explain what modern... So, from what I understand, modern monetary theory is that what I understand is that government basically creates money by spending, and taxation is mostly like this valve to control inflation. You know, it's just basically government collecting back its IOUs. You know, like its tokens it gave, it's collecting them back to control the, you know, like the flow of tokens so that there aren't too many, you know? Right. So that's like, I'm sure someone will have a problem with the way I mentioned it, but that's how we understand it. So the idea comes from like, you know, it's based in Keynesian ideas of sometimes there's not enough aggregate demand simply because, let's say, workers don't have money. So you just kind of,
give them spend money
into existence so that there's enough aggregate demand to, you basically spend money into existence by, you know, basically you print money and that generates,
it generates liquidity, which generates production, which creates real value eventually.
Yeah, exactly.
Except they would be offended that I even said real value because they don't think that's a thing, but
so for that to work, theoretically, I don't know, it's like a theoretical, I will imagine you need to have so that there shouldn't be production bottlenecks. So if you create enough aggregate demand by spending money into existence and just the government generating this full-time job guaranteed program, so now there's all these workers that supposedly are rich, you know? And so in theory, there shouldn't be production bottlenecks, you know? So like if workers want, they have money to buy food, and new TVs, the economy should like speed the TVs and the food, you know? But most countries actually have production bottlenecks because most countries are not industrially sovereign. So for example, the US, arguably maybe, you know, like the US could probably like, if it took itself out from the world market, it could probably become like, I guess this is like super speculative. I don't know, but I guess you could make the case that maybe the US could be taken out, let's say, from the world market and just print money, you know, because they are very economically advanced. They have a lot of
natural resources, although some key ones they don't have, but yeah.
They have labor, many natural resources, and also they have the trade secrets and the capital intensive industries to generate technology. But in other countries, if you stimulate, if you generate money and all these jobs with that, people will want to buy even the most fundamental goods, like even food, you know, they might have to import it. You know, the economy itself cannot produce it. So let's say, for example, the UK. The UK is just like an island that operates on magical computer money. So if they could, like, you know, increase its supply of money just to stimulate the economy, but because they cannot produce the goods they need internally, they will have to import them. So that will automatically mean they will have to buy dollars with their currency.
Which would open them up to inflation and value for a variety of things.
And this is like, this is actually what happened to Allende, partly. So, this is the interpretation I got from, there's this book about CyberSign. I don't remember the author, but it's like, it was all over. It's called, let me look for it. Oh, Cybernetic Revolutionaries.
Mm-hmm.
Which is a very interesting book. I recommend people to read it, by Eden Medina. Mm-hmm. Anyway, she was mentioning about how, I don't know, I haven't read more sources, so maybe I'm misunderstanding her, or she might not have all the information, but basically it seemed that Allende in his initial years, like, you know, like, basically increased, in some sense, it increased the, I'm not sure exactly about his specific policies, but I know he definitely raised the minimum wage, and a lot of people were just getting paid much more money. But what ended up happening is that there were all these people with money, but the problem was that there were no goods to buy with the money. That was one of the initial problems Allende had, because, you know, like, Chile was a small economy, right? So it was mostly based on the export of copper, if I remember correctly. So that was a problem they faced, actually, because at the end of the day, you know, there's you cannot just, like, extract wealth from the ground just out of seigneurialism, you know, just because you like, oh, there's just more money around, so there's more wealth. No, like, if there's more money around, you want to expect for the economy to produce the goods that could be circulated through the exchange of that money. But I don't think that's that easy, you know? And you see it in, I don't know, I think in my opinion, you know, like, for example, some of the problems of countries like Venezuela, you know, someone is going to, I don't know, an MMT guy is going to say it's because they pegged the Bolivar to the dollar or something. But I don't know. But in internationalist terms, like, I mean, it's an oil-based economy. So its whole economy is based on, I sell oil and then I get dollars, and then through the dollars I buy goods. Once there's, like, huge inflation and devaluation of currency, it becomes a problem, you know? So in conclusion, like, to me, like, long scale, we should always fight for the idea of, the end game should be, like, world socialist government, and maybe immediate term is, like, you know, some sort of continental socialism. So I think a socialist movement in Latin America should probably strive for, like, you know, the socialist states, United Socialist States of Latin America, you know?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, I sort of like the United Socialist States of North America, but yeah, I mean, I see these issues profoundly. It does make trying for a Marxist way of handling the United States really interesting, because there is a way in which we've had to talk about the United States as kind of Manichean terms, like, if we can get it to go red, everything will turn, or conversely, it's the great Satan which must be defeated at all times. And I don't know how you could ever build a politics off of either one of those, really. Like, I do think, you know, the United States is going to have to be involved eventually, but it's going to be one of the harder countries to turn. I mean, the incentives in the United States are not the same, and its history isn't quite there either. So there's not a pre-existent long-term, like, political representation of the labor movement, really. For example,
that's a good question, because I think usually people have these very unnuanced views on the role of first world, or, like, let's use, like, more accurate terms, like the global north or the core economy, the core countries. So the core countries, people have really unnuanced views about it. Some people just kind of see that. So there's the one of the more Maoist kind of thing of third world, this kind of thing that these guys are, you know, like imperialist satans or something, and there's no hope for them, so you just organize, I don't know, I guess what you do in third world countries, then first world countries is, like, organize solidarity campaigns with the third world or something, I don't know, along the line, except for exceptional demographics, for example, in Canada, the question of First Nations, who are, many of them basically live with third world or worse than third world country conditions in a rich and supposedly enlightened country like Canada. So there's that view, but there's also the view that these countries like are almost the only thing that matters because they have the high, they have the economy and the high technical capacity to have socialism, and also the huge asymmetries between the core and the third and the periphery are only have to do with the fact only that the economy is more advanced and productive. There's no like geopolitical arrangements that exacerbate these asymmetries.
Mm.
So that's the more Western Marxist kind of take. But like, I think, I don't know, I'm more in the middle. Like, to me, imperialism is real, and it's not just something that all countries are imperialist. Some leftists say that, you know, some Marxists say that, and that's how they wash their hands. No, there's an imperialist pecking order that exacerbates the existence of periphery and core. For example, a very interesting paper I read from Monthly Reviews was, I think it was John Smith.
Mm-hmm.
My name is John Smith. And he traces how, like, you know, like people make a shirt in like, fucking, I don't know, like, yeah, in Bangladesh or something mm-hmm. like that. And how once it crosses the border, suddenly the price just gets inflated, like, by an order of magnitude because of all the, like, part of it is like also the administrative overhead in the first world of taking this to there, you know?
Mm-hmm.
While at the same time, the shirt might have costed like, I don't remember the exact cost, but like a couple of cents, but then it ends up being like $30 in H&M or something.
Mm-hmm.
So like, I mean, I don't think it's just like, I think there's like geopolitical arrangements that make those things easier. You know, I don't think it's just, oh, like the first world economy is more advanced, because at the same time, people who do extremely menial work in first world countries, like they get paid like an order of magnitude more money or more than the person that does it in the developing world. And it's just like menial, not capital intensive work.
Even when you adjust for, I was reading a book by a former Maoist who was trying to pick up on the labor aristocracy idea, but he didn't tie it to nations because he also talked about subsectors within the economy. But he did make that point that you can, even when you adjust for price purchasing parity, so for basically cost of living, it's still off, like by a lot. It is, weirdly though, it's getting better. This is one of the things where I have noticed some things that the left hasn't been able to really talk about. In some areas, it actually is getting better, the discrepancies, but not in Latin America. It seems mostly to be in China. But I don't know that I would consider China not to be part of the core anymore. So that was my big argument with the Wallerstein people. And then I was like, you know what, I can accept your argument if you make China part of the core, even though it's a different core.
China is weird because I don't know much about China, but it has like huge rural urban asymmetry. So part of the reason, so even China itself is, you could think of a Chinese core and a Chinese periphery almost.
For definitely, and it's formally enforced by internal passports, for sure.
Yeah.
And the reason why it's justified by the CCP is they don't want a lumping class developing in the cities, so you know, that's why it's there. But you're not wrong. At Foxconn, there's lots of illegal immigrants, and I'm putting that in quotation marks for people who can't see it because it's a podcast, at Foxconn, but they're from parts of China that just don't have permission to work there. So yeah, there's definitely that. But I also saw Chinese operations in North Africa when I was there, and they were like, the former British foreign sector where the Americans used to be, there's two of them. There's Mahdi and Zamelik. And Mahdi's Chinatown now. I lived in, like, most of my neighbors were Chinese. And I go down and get, like Cantonese cooking and stuff. And there's this weird, it feels very much kind of like the Marshall Plan, you know? But it's hard to say because the one thing that complicates this is China's very hard to categorize economically if you look at it, like, really deeply. Because there's lots of millionaires and billionaires there, but there's also, I think, what is it? I think 60% of the economy is still technically owned by the state in some capacity. So it's very weird. I don't even by most state capitalist theories, it doesn't seem to operate exactly the way you think it would. So
it's, No, I agree. It's, I don't know much about it, but I wish I knew more about Keynes economy. It's like, I don't know, it reminds me a bit of NEP, NEP stage of the USSR.
Yeah, but it lasting for a century instead of 20 years. It does operate kind of capitalistically abroad, so it's very weird. But I just say that because I feel like anytime I talk about China, I'm going to get thrown, you know, some weird argument about what it is. But I don't think you can call the largest producing nation with, like, the second largest number of billionaires not part of the core economy either.
No, yeah, I mean, I think it's core-like.
Yeah, core-like or... Yeah.
Or some parts of it. Because the GDP per capita of China is actually pretty low, like, I don't know, less than $10,000.
No, you're right. But then again, the GDP per capita of the United States is not as high as you'd think it'd be. But yeah, I mean, that's a fair point. And I guess one of the problems with talking about world systems theory is it's still hard to talk about it not in terms of nation states.
Yeah.
I mean, even world systems theory, we're still largely talking about nation states, and it's hard not to, for reasons, I think you're right, imperialism, for reasons of different sectors of the economy work differently. But you know what frustrates me right now, and to kind of turn this back and kind of wrap this up a little bit, but there's a lot of theoretical discussion on Marxist circles, and there's a lot of political tactics discussion right now because of the essay. And admittedly, that's new. We haven't seen that in a while. There's very little empirical analysis of crap.
So when I write something, I always try to, even if I don't put charts, at least cite some data somewhere else where that has the charts that prove my point. Because I think, I mentioned this in my last paper, well, my last article. Marxism, there's a lot of, but what Nassim Taleb refers to, and I stole, like, Aristotelian arguments.
Mm-hmm.
You just, you think you can chop yourself into the truth, logically chop yourself into the truth with just logical inference.
Mm.
A very good example is the, Marxist crisis theory. It's a lot of them, but arguably the more orthodox one is the tendency for the rate of profit to fall. And it's based on certain logical relations, logical, pseudo-mathematical, quasi-mathematical relations between specific political economic variables. So what Marx referred as constant capital, which is basically the machinery and raw materials,
mm-hmm.
variable capital, which is labor, basically, and surplus value, which is, you know, like the profit a capitalist makes from paying a worker less than the hours the worker worked. So Chris's theory is based on the logical relations of this, that basically that it comes down to the idea that profit comes from exploitation of workers. If there's no workers, you know, let's say like if the economy was all like robots, capitalism will collapse because you cannot exploit a robot. You know, like a robot costs what it costs, right, to make.
Mm-hmm.
While the human being, they can work 10 hours and you just pay them for two or something, you know?
Yeah, my friend Douglas Lane makes that argument, and he argues that automation isn't a threat to capitalism for that reason, that it just wouldn't be profitable and thus won't be pursued beyond a certain threshold.
Yeah, but my point is that it's very clean, logical inference arguments on these variables.
Right.
While capitalism should be considered itself a system and look globally instead of just looking at these relations of these specific variables. So what I was trying to say is that instead of looking at you know, the specific variables, which I think is like really hard. I mean, Michael Roberts and other economists argue that empirical data back those arguments, but I think the only thing those arguments prove is that they show data of, like, for example, secular fall of the rate of profit, which has appeared at least since the 70s and is well documented.
Mm-hmm.
And they also argue that, you know, they sometimes track the, what is called the organic composition of capital, which is how much capital is basically spent in workers versus like machinery, you know? Mm-hmm. So there's, I guess, ways to track that, but it's all like aggregating data in economics is not trivial. It goes with assumptions, but anyway, like Robert showed that, yeah, the rate of profit is falling and also the organic composition of capital is increasing at the same time. But to me, that's not really that controversial.
Yeah, it's true, but that doesn't actually get to everything that's going on.
Yeah, that doesn't mean it's based on this logical relationship with these variables. Yeah, these two variables happen to correlate, but it's not necessarily because of Marxist categories. There's so many explanations that you can have for that. So to me, like, trying to, like, a better research program, in my opinion, will be looking at a capitalist as a system, how it generates fragile complexity, because you can actually model that. You can model how certain, you can make simple models of how complexity exponentially increases, and how, and you could probably make also model of how is it can sustain a shock, you know? So that's what mainstream economists do. They don't do the complexity thing, but the dynamic stochastic general equilibrium model, like, it's but anyway, that model, they model the economy at equilibrium. They model it at equilibrium, then they, in a simulation, they just subject it to random shocks and see how the economy behaves. So I think that an aspect of that is correct, but you want to also measure how, instead of just looking at endogenous shocks like they do, is how capitalist creates, no, exogenous shocks, which they do from the outside, how capitalist creates from the inside, from its own loss of motion, complexity that is fragile to shocks. There's that too, and also you could, also ultimately how it could, you know, at the end of the day, the wealth of the world comes from construction workers building and dentists doing dentistry, not dentists sitting in an office and trading stocks, you know?
Yeah, because there's a difference between wealth and value. But yeah, I completely agree with you in a lot of sense. You know, I do actually think that the decline of the rate of profit is mostly true, but I also agree with you at a certain point, like, so what? Like, that generates a business cycle. Yeah. Like, we know business cycles exist. We don't know how they get resolved, because they get resolved a million different ways. So like, they obviously don't get resolved usually in revolution. So, like, those other systems are more, in some ways more important.
Well, there's two things that are important. It's like, first, there's a tendency for the rate of profit to fall, which, at least in the cities, is, I think, is an empirical fact. Like, you can find, like, mainstream think tanks talking about it. You can go to the Brookings Institute website, and they have documents on falling productivity and GDP generation, and I actually put some of them in some of my articles. But, and there's also the business cycle, which is just an oscillation. So it's to the two things. There's a falling rate of profit on the business cycle. So you have to find a way to model both.
What do you think of Michael Roberts' use of Kondrev long cycles? Is it just too speculative or what?
I read just a little bit about the Kondratiev cycles in his side, but I'm a little bit skeptical. I don't know. It seems one of those things that...
I don't know how you compare 100-year, like, 120-year economies to each other exactly, but...
A fact about, like, math is that a lot of things are kind of, like, cyclical, and you could always, like, put a wave function into it, you know? You can fit, like, a sine, you know? So that's how I feel the Kondratiev cycle is. You know, you just... You're like, there's this big large-scale oscillations that they use, like, fit the sine function and then speculate about its origins. But maybe I'm not being, like, too charitable about it. I don't know enough about it, but that's how it always struck me.
Right, but well, here's the thing I'm going to point out to our listeners, is that you know the math enough to know that that's a possibility. Most Marxists, including a lot of people who are involved with this channel, this podcast is going to appear on, could not check this math. They can't.
Yeah. Sometimes it's not even... So there's specific parts about math. It's not just the calculation, but there's an intuition involved. And I just know from being a scientist that you can, like, fit, like, a harmonic oscillator to a lot of things. Like, that's, like, the basis of, like... undergraduate textbook physics, like, the joke is that, you know, everything is a... So harmonic oscillator is just a... It's just like a very simple oscillator you see in nature, you know, like a pendulum. It could be like a pendulum. It could be a spring with a weight oscillating. So a lot of physics is just like harmonic oscillator. Like, so to me, it's just like, there's a periodic motion. So what?
Yeah. Right, that pattern's all over nature, man.
So, like, I don't know. But yeah. Maybe I'm just, like, ignorant and uncharitable. I haven't read enough into it, but
I've read a couple of articles that sounded to me, like, it sounded to me feasible, but I had no way of how I would test it. Because, you know, if you're looking at capitalism as a system that maybe has a 400-year history, you'd only have 3 or 4 of those waves. Like... So
yeah, exactly. Too. So there's not even that much data about it. Yeah. So, like, I don't know. I think to me, a task of socialists will mean to make the economy more intelligible. Mm-hmm. So now the economy is opaque because of complexity, endogenous complexity of the market. You know, there's all a combination of rent sinkers, finance, managerial decisions, just create all this ad hoc complexity. I heard this term from software engineering that actually fits the bill. It's called technical debt. Mm. So in software, apparently, you know, let's say you like were hired by a software firm and you generate a code. The code will have problems. You know, it's not going to be perfect probably. So you have to hire another guy to fix the problems. But then it gets more complex. And, you know, that stuff might have other unforeseen, like, consequences that needs to be managed. So it's like a feedback loop. So capital is basically a technical debt problem in many ways. It's actually a, like, I agree with Tainter. That's why I think capitalist decline, it's a very common characteristic of moribund systems. It's like huge technical debt. For example, that was a problem with the USSR. So the USSR, I don't know, I read this writer, Donald Fitzer, and he, one of the things, and also Tikhtin has this similar argument, is that one of the characteristic loss of motion of the Soviet Union was waste. So what happened is that because it got industrialized in a very half-assed way, so you had like Stalin and his 5 years plan of like, yeah, let's just generate steel production like on this to this ridiculous height, you know? And then, so you just had this frenzied, you know, like people trying to like, in some sense, get to task done, but also like by juking these stats and fucking with them. So you had like this dislocation where you, for example, a part of the planned economy will generate something way faster than the other. So there will be they will require maybe some pieces or goods from another industry, but there will be shortage because it was not synergistic, you know? Mm-hmm. So what ended up happening is that Stalin industrialized the USSR really quickly like that and just proletarianized peasants like that. But at the end of the day, like the rest of the USSR, a lot of the stuff being produced because of these problems was waste. So like it was useless. So what you ended up having is that people produce all this shit, but it doesn't work. Or, you know, like glass is too thin, the shoes, you know, the fucking factory directors skimped on the leather, you know. So all this immense accumulation of shoddy goods. So you will get all these feedback loops of like, you know, technical debt, you know, the system trying to resolve the problems
created by the subpar system in the first place.
Exactly. So you will have like an immense industry that's just repairing, you know, and fixing because nothing worked. But it will have been expensive to like restructure the society in scientific terms because of technical debt. And that was part of why you became sick and it will collapse in any time. That's what Tikhtin said. It lasts a human lifetime, but then it collapsed. And I think you see this in a lot of modes of production. So capitalism, I think it's in like its technical debt phase. That's why you get like diminishing marginal returns. A lot of it is just feedback loops of complexity generating by technical debt previously made. And also, yeah, like also a combination of the low hanging fruits for capitalism, you know, like, so capitalism is structured in a certain way to solve problems in a certain way, and the low-hanging fruits for that have also disappeared and been plucked, you know? So in conclusion, I think part of why modes of production, you could say it like capitalist decline, is because there's this immense technical debt, you know, that just makes the whole thing. It generates wealth for some firms and individuals, but I don't think it's that efficient at problem-solving anymore at the global scale.
All right. So we're to end off on that and with the idea that your writing is aimed to get people to think about making socialist economics intelligible and making economics in general intelligible. Yeah. And that's a good mission. And particularly right now, because I feel like right now we're in a moment, and I'll end us off, where people actually aren't thinking that much about the economics of things. They're thinking more about the immediate politics of things.
Yeah, exactly.
On the Marxist left, which is a strange shift from where we were like 5 years ago or 3 years ago. But you know, if we don't got the economics down, then it won't matter.
No, yeah, I agree. I think economics is very important. And also, economics is important. And also, like, so one of the things that I was trying to do in my blog is that there's all these blogs and theory being made that's very inward-seeking and almost hermeneutics. You know, you just like juggle Marxist, you just concatenate Marxist abstractions, and that's right. What you call theory. But to me, like a real research program will be more eclectic. So I always try to not only read, synthesize the mainstream, the left sources, but like mainstream, you know, like I actually try to like read what mainstream policymakers and economists are trying to say and how they defend themselves and then contrast it to like maybe my take slash the leftist take. Because I think sometimes I try to like look at scholarly articles from other fields and synthesize them instead of just like looking at my inside my own turf, you know? And I think that's what we need to do. And I think there isn't that much of that, or that at least is done in a publicly accessible, digestible form. Maybe some guy in some, I don't know, you could find some grad student somewhere who might do something related to that in a very academic setting. But what I'm trying to do is more like, to me, for example, Marx, when he was building his system, he read a shit ton of stuff in, you know, like the Museum of Natural, I think it's the Museum of Natural History, or what's the London Museum, or the library at the London Museum of...
Yeah, the library at the London. Anyway, it's a huge library, and also a Stax archive, so we could find like bunches of like huge reams of raw data, and he was going through that.
Yeah, he was going through that, and he was not looking inside, you know? He built his own system based on researching the facts and the data out there, and then not being dogmatic about it. You know, like, this is data, so I'm trying to extract a story out of it. Meanwhile, what happens is the opposite. You know, you have, like, Marx categories already there, so you just try to, like, force things into them 100%, you know, and into the story that was already laid. But people forget that Marx was a scientist, you know, and I don't mean scientist in, like, just... Some people say, oh, you know, like scientific socialism is this. It just means that it's not utopian. And you like, instead of coming up with hair-wired visions of the future, you base your analysis on what's the class movement and what's going on right now sociologically and historically. But beyond that, to me, Marx was a scientist too, because he was a guy that was trying to synthesize all this data out there in a systematic manner and trying to discover some underlying laws in it. But it was not just like inward looking. He was not just like, if in some sense he may have been the disciple of Hegel or something, he wasn't like, oh, I'm just going to use Hegel's categories to talk about things, you know, like he just, some of it was inspired on it, but he obviously, Marxism is not the same as Hegelianism.
So we have to put some notion of science back in scientific socialism and remember that empirical data, even if you're a dialectician, and you know, I don't want to get into this because it's a whole other thing. I tend to think complexity theory is actually just like a more advanced and slightly more scientific form of dialectics because you're looking at opposing trends and how they create
systems. Yeah, that's what I think, actually. I see it like, that's why I like complexity science a lot. It's like some of the heuristics of dialectics, but like in a less bullshitty manner. Like, I mean, there's a lot of shit in it. I'm not going to lie. Complexity science, one of those boss, like trendy scientific boss words nowadays, because its scope is more limited than people think. Like, you still cannot like fucking simulate. Like, a lot of complexity stuff is mathematical, but almost qualitative. Sure, there's some, it has some toy models or something to represent ideas, but there, it's limited. And complexity science acknowledges that. Like, these are nonlinear systems that sometimes may be subject to chaos, you know? But yeah, anyway. Yeah, I agree with you. But it's...
Yeah, because I also wanted to point people to is, even though you're coming down very harsh on Hegelianism and Hegel a little bit, you actually do defend the central thesis of Hegel that history has intelligible patterns.
Yeah, exactly.
You know, and that you can kind of see where things are going based off that. Thanks for talking to me. Maybe we'll do this again. Everybody should go read Cold Dark Stars. It is at a time when starting a blog on socialism is actually a lot harder than it was, say, 10 years ago. Like, it was really easy 10 years ago. Trust me. I saw my own blog numbers drop so low that I quit doing it. But you've created a really accessible blog that talks about things that other people aren't talking about. And so... if you are fascinated by any of the conversation that came up between Amir and I today, you should go check out that blog because he goes into way more detail. But the posts aren't very long. You're not reading books, guys. So you can normally read one in about 20 minutes. Thanks, Amir.